I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Hello and welcome to the Manchester Is Red podcast. My name is Stephen Railston and we're recording this episode on the Monday afternoon after Manchester United's 2-1 win against Aston Villa at Villa Park at the weekend. I'm joined by Tyrone Marshall. There's no Samuel Luckhurst today. For personal reasons, he's unavailable, unfortunately. But Tyrone, you're in the hot seat. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you, Stephen. Yeah, I'm good. Grateful for the last minute call up. Having dashed here from Manchester City's open training. They're playing in the Champions League this week.
What's the Champions League?
No idea. Never heard of it.
United are going to be back in the Champions League anyways after that result. There you go. Okay. It's nice to rekindle our relationship, Tyrone. I've missed you.
Been a while.
It has.
It's been a while.
Nice to see you in person again. Anyways, to the listeners, in this episode, we'll get into the Villa performance. A fantastic win. A really important, crucial 3 points. And at the back end of the podcast, we'll talk about some transfer bits. And just a quick note from the editor, if you're watching on YouTube, apologies if the light is changing. The sun is coming through the window and I've been told there's nothing we can do about it because producer Seb isn't God, Tyrone.
No, he acts like it sometimes, but he definitely isn't God. And also, sun in Manchester in February, we can't really complain, can we?
It's a very much needed vitamin D, I think. Anyways, Ty, 6 undefeated in all competitions, 3 wins on the bounce, another really positive podcast. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it is. It's going very well, isn't it? They are, like you say, they've definitely put themselves back in the top four race. I don't think by any stretch things are perfect. When that game went 1-1 yesterday, I don't think anyone thought there's only one winner and it's United with the way it was going, but they did win. And I think, I kind of wrote this piece today, I think they've kind of shown their biggest strength over the last couple of weeks, and that's character all of a sudden. Like what happened at Wolves, the way they were cruising, they threw it away and then found a way to win it. At Villa, I mean, they were never cruising, really. They were under a lot of pressure, conceded. And as soon as they conceded, I think we all thought they're going to lose this game. And they found a way to win it. And at the moment, they are showing a stomach for the fight. They're showing character. They've got players, the guy of your shoulder on the wall there, Casemiro, who's, he's playing a lot better than he was in the first half of the season, but he brings that kind of character and fight as well. I mean, him and Fernandez just moaned and complained about everything in midfield yesterday. And I know we're critical of that sometimes, but that kind of spikiness did feel like it worked yesterday. Højlund has never lacked for character and attitude, but we're seeing more of it now, I think. Now he's in form with his goals. Like, even just the way he went off when he was subbed yesterday, just like arguing with everyone,
swearing up to everyone. Did you see the clip of... People thought it was a member of Villa staff. I think it was actually a fan wearing like a Villa coat.
Well, I wondered what it was. I wasn't sure if it was a ball boy or something, just giving him loads of grief behind.
It would be a disgrace if that was like a member of Villa staff. No, I think it was a fan. I think it was a fan in official gear. But he was giving Højlund a mouthload of abuse, wasn't he? Yeah. I think Højlund just kind of laughed. I think he actually put his hands up to say 2-1 or something. Oh, I can't remember at that point. Yeah. But an interesting little observation.
It was. Like, that moment was funny because he was clearly taking forever to go off the pitch, wanted to go off a different way, squared up to one of the Villa players. Just general time wasting. But you see in that kind of edge and that spikiness, which I think we've always seen in Højlund's game, but it feels like there's a lot of that running through the team at the moment. Maguire's leadership feels like it's back. Now his form is back. He was talking to the ref a lot yesterday. He was looking more like a captain than he did.
I sent a jokey message during the game to Liam Coulis, actually, obviously formerly of them, and I said, Maguire's the de facto captain of us in the game. That's what it felt like.
It did. It felt like he was more demonstrative then than he ever was when he was captain. And I think that's partly because he's got his confidence back. He's playing really, really well at the moment. And I think, I don't want to be negative from the get-go. I think there are still issues there that are concerning me, but the fact that they are showing this character and they're getting wins, and they've had, those 3 successive wins are against teams who at the time were rivals with them, really. Wolves could have gone above them if they'd won. West Ham were above United. Villa still are above United. And they've beaten them all and found ways to win, really, in 2 of those games when it's felt like they'd kind of missed their chance. And I think Wolves and Villa are probably his 2 best away wins in Ten Hag's entire tenure. So there's definitely more momentum now than at any stage since the first weekend of the season.
Is that the best away win of his tenure yet? Definitely. I mean, considering Villa are the best home team in the Premier League this season, very few teams have actually gone there and got a result. Have wobbled a little bit recently, but we'll not mention that. goals ultimately decide the narrative. I mean, Villa could have scored, as you said themselves, so were piling on the pressure, weren't they? I mean, coming in at half-time, it could have been 1-1, and it did feel like that goal was coming after the break. Obviously, Douglas Luiz equalised. And after that, I think that, like you said, I think we all thought Villa would get the goal, but it was United who did. Let's discuss the actual goal itself then. I mean, we've briefly touched on Højlund, but we'll talk about McTominay first. There was kind of a speculative ball forward from Casemiro. And I just mentioned before we came on air, Kobbie Mainoo's involvement, which I think has probably went under the radar. His touch was actually, he took it inwards towards the goal. And a lot of players in that position might have panicked. And Douglas Luiz was standing up, but he kind of turned back out. I think there was an element of fortune with it, because it kind of went off Jacob Ramsey. But anyways, ball went to Diogo Dalot. What a cross, Tyrone. A perfect cross. It was David Beckham-esque, wasn't it? Yeah. And a powerful header from Scott McTominay, who does it again.
I think
me and you were on the Brentford podcast in October, when it was 2-1 and McTominay scored the brace.
Yeah.
Remarkable.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, every time he plays, he's getting a lot. He's getting into some dangerous positions, McTominay, at the moment. And you know, I mean, there's a few things within that. The substitutions that kind of happened at the same time, when Bailey went off for Villa and Rashford went off for McTominay for United, they both kind of changed the game in that at that point, the flow was all Villa attacking United, and Bailey was at the heart of a lot of it. He gave Lindelof a pretty horrible time, really. But it did feel like at that point, Villa kind of started to settle for a draw. And
I think both sides did, didn't they?
Yeah, I think they both did a little bit, yeah. The tempo definitely dropped a bit. And I think that was mostly down to Villa, because it was Villa setting the tempo at that point. And it kind of felt like the game was there to be won for Villa. And it was almost like they made that change. And I don't know if they made that change with the intention of holding on, because you could see, you know, Emery started to get a bit more agitated on the touchline at the way things were going. But the change didn't work for them. And even the change for United, you look at it and you think McTominay for Rashford is a defensive change. But we've seen what a threat McTominay can be in the final third.
Well, you made the point, I think it was after that podcast, after the Brentford game, that Sir Alex Ferguson would have always made a role in his teams for someone like McTominay. And we talked about his merits in these attacking scenarios, coming late in the box. And he's now got 7 league goals, and that's more, I think, than his last 3 seasons combined in the league. He's scored 6 in his last 3 seasons, which he's in the form of his life, isn't he, in front of goal?
Absolutely. You know, scored a header at Wolves when he came on, scored a header at Villa now when he's come on. And, you know, a great person to have when you can name 9 subs these days, because as we've seen, he can come on and be an attacking threat. You can play him as a number 10. You can play him as a second striker to win headers. You can play him in really advanced areas. And although he's maybe not technically the best, what he is good at is finding space and positions to get shots away. And he's, you know, he's always been really good at kind of picking those moments and those runs to make around the area.
Ten Hag says he can smell a goal, can't he?
Yeah,
he's used that word a few times.
Yeah, you can definitely sense that he just knows where the ball's going to go and what position to be. And he's really good at finding that space. But we know he can probably help come on and help shut a game down as well. If United had been winning that game, he could have come on for Rashford and played deeper. So definitely someone to have around the building for sure. And on Dalot, I thought the interesting thing with that cross is that they'd actually had a dangerous attack, maybe even pretty much the same move, but a minute and a half before maybe, where Dalot was in a really good crossing position and tried to take his man on. I think it might have been Digne at the time, and tried to take his man on, and just, he made the wrong decision in taking him on, and it kind of lacked conviction. I think United want to throw in from it, but it was a dangerous counter-attack, really, it felt like. It felt like Dalot just got it wrong. He took the wrong decision in taking his man on. He couldn't work half a yard, and he couldn't get his crossing. And then, you know, 90 seconds, 2 minutes later, the ball falls to him, and he puts a ball like that in, which, whether it's Højlund, whether it's McTominay, it was just absolutely asking to be attacked.
Put your head on that something.
Yeah. You're, as a striker or a forward, your eyes would light up when a ball like that comes in.
Obviously, we've talked about how many goals McTominay scored, but kind of the importance of those goals. His brace against Brentford in October, that was 2-1. Obviously, he scored both. He scored twice against Chelsea in December, that was 2-1 again. And then he scored a header, obviously, against Villa, 2-1 again. So that's 9 points. If you take away his 2 goals in both the games against Brentford and Chelsea, I mean, that's just 1 point, really, isn't it, from that run? So that's a huge difference. United are on 41 points now, and they're in 6. I know football's not that simple, but if you took away those goals, because other players could have scored in those games.
Yeah, they could.
But if they didn't, United would be sitting in 9th and they would be on 33 points. Mm. So And considering this was a player who could have left in the summer and Ten Hag was open to selling, he's made such a difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it is the case that some players just do score more important goals than others. You know, it's always been the case that players, there are certain players that feel like they step up at the moments when they're most needed. And I think McTominay
like is... Like me at five-a-side.
Like you at five-a-side,
Stephen. When I'm not done attacking your ankles.
Yeah, mostly you are attacking people's ankles, so I'll have to keep an eye out for the moments when you're stepping up instead. But no, I think McTominay falls into that category that when the going gets tough and there's, you know, the game needs someone to make an impact, then he is often there and can be that man. And we saw it with this goal. We saw it at Wolves in a way, because although so much happened after that, it felt like at the time his goal, his header to make it 3-1, which was a really good header. Really strange watching that live, because it was one of those where you had no idea from behind how it had actually gone in, and then you see it and how he's kind of cushioned the head of someone jumping in front of him. But at the time it felt like, with Wolves having just scored, United going 3-1 up, it was like, well, he's killed the game off now. And obviously he hadn't, but it still felt like an important goal at the time. And, you know, I think he's definitely someone who kind of senses the moment and senses the hour of need, as he did against Brentford, of course. That was my famous one.
Well, end this part by talking about Højlund, of course. I mean, 5 goals in 5 games now. We wondered when it would click. We said it was only a matter of if, not when, and it really has clicked in an emphatic manner now. It's great to see him scoring, because the potential was always there, but he's playing with a real confidence and swagger now, and that was a scruffy centre-forward's goal, and I love how he scores those type of goals.
Yeah, and we're seeing a lot more of them. His goal at Wolves was like that, scruffy, just bundling it over the line, finding a way to get it over the line. And he had a pretty good opportunity before that goal, when I thought he'd actually done really well to create it. It pressed and he won the ball in a really dangerous area. Got the ball back from Fernandes and then just couldn't really get it out of his feet. But yeah, it was right place, right time, really. And I think for a long time, United have lacked a striker that does that. I mean, that is not the type of goal that you can imagine Anthony Martial ever scoring, or Rashford, really. You know, Cavani did score goals like that, but obviously his impact was pretty brief, really. So it's promising to have a player like that. And, you know, it is amazing how that goal against Villa on Boxing Day has just changed
everything. But we said that, though. One goal can change everything.
It can.
It gets your confidence, it spikes your confidence, it gets you going. And look at him now, he's flying, isn't he?
It is, yeah.
It really is.
And then the strange thing is that you didn't watch Højlund in those 10, 11 games when he didn't score and think he is lacking confidence. And, you know, I asked Ten Hag about it after Wolves, actually, and to talk about his character and his attitude, really, rather than like his technical traits. And he was full of praise for it, and about how he, you know, when things weren't going well for him, he never went missing. He still took on chances, he still took on shots, he still got in the right areas. There was never really a moment when he looked like a player on a long goal drought. And sometimes just the way it goes, that suddenly everything you hit goes in, and that's what we're seeing at the moment. And it's huge for United, because they'd have been, you know, around Christmas, New Year, Ineos should have been looking at that thinking, right, we need a striker in the summer, and we might need a £100 million striker, we might need an Osimhen type who can lead the line. Whereas now they're looking at it and going, well, maybe this guy is actually ready to lead the line. You know, I think he's had to do more this season than United would have wanted or expected, and more than probably is fair on him, because let's not forget, he's still pretty inexperienced. But the way it's going at the moment, you wouldn't worry about it if he was to start and striker next season. I don't think he looks kind of ready to take that mantle on, though.
Still only 21 as well. Obviously celebrated his birthday last weekend. I mean, he's coming to the boil at the right time, isn't he? It's the business end of the season. It's a cliche, but if you want your striker to start scoring, it's this time of year, heading into March, April, when the games actually mean something. So that's great to see as well. We'll leave it there for part one and we'll be back in a moment for part two.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal.
Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Welcome back to part two of the Manchester is Red podcast. Now, I think we'll have to give a mention to Harry Maguire as well, Tyrone. It was exceptional. pardon me. Obviously, Lisandro Martinez has come out of the team with injuries, expected to be sidelined for around 8 weeks. Maguire started on the left, ran on the right. Obviously, Luke Shaw was at left back again. But Maguire just won absolutely everything in the air, didn't he? He was imperious, really, at both ends, defensively and attacking scenarios. And it was his header from the corner. I can't remember who was marking him from the corners.
Kamara.
And that was such a mismatch, wasn't it? Yeah. Gary Neville wouldn't shut up about it on commentary, but yeah. But it was a mismatch. And he won the header that Højlund scored from. Yeah. I just thought he was fantastic.
Yeah, he was really good. You know, fantastic defensively. Just so few errors in his game at the moment. And we've spoken about it a couple of times on the podcast. I think he deserves so much praise for the way he's gone about things this season. And we spoke about it when he wasn't playing well, and when he wasn't playing well, the criticism he got was so over the top. And the way, you know, I described him as a pantomime villain, and that's what he was for a long time. You know, he was the pre-season tours when he's been booed, when he came on for England at Scotland and was just...
Yeah, that was as recently as... Was that September?
September,
I was
looking
at that.
And it was the same when he came on against Arsenal, came on for United against Arsenal, when the game was level. And Arsenal fans just cheered his every touch, like they knew a mistake was coming. And it was just really strange how this £80 million defender, who is not worth £80 million, but just how he'd become this figure of fun, basically.
Well, two reasons. One, he plays for Manchester United. Yeah. Two, he's English. I mean, that obviously if you go to Scotland, that comment applies more than when you're south of the border. Yeah. But if you play for United, you are going to be a target. And I guess a few high-profile mistakes, an £80 million player... But again, the kind of, as you said, the criticism, it spilled over into the personal stuff, didn't it? It was personal vitriol.
Yeah.
And it was bang out of order. It did go too far.
Totally over the top. And, you know, I thought Gareth Southgate was really good at pointing it out, actually, and how this kind of monster had been created around Maguire, that he was just there to be ridiculed and poked fun at. And don't get me wrong, when he plays badly, we can say he plays badly. But some of the, you know, some of the abuse he got, some of the stick he got, and not, you know, him being cheered by Scotland and Arsenal fans isn't really abuse, but it's just like parody, isn't it? It's like Mickey taking and just so weird.
One of those incidents on its own is you don't think anything of it, but yeah. It was the fact that all these things come together, don't you?
Yeah.
And that, a pantomime villain's the way
it is. Pantomime villain is what it is, yeah. And it takes a player of immense character, I think, to get over that. And it would have been so easy for him in the summer just to say, like, right, this ain't working. I need to get out of being the centre of attention here and go and play for West Ham under the radar, where not every game is first or second on match of the day, and they might do 30 seconds on it and they're not talking about me. But he didn't. He stuck it out. He had belief that he'd win his place back, and he's been absolutely fantastic, and he did. You know, he was great again on Sunday. And me and Rich spoke on the podcast on Friday about how they'd missed Martinez, and especially kind of from an attacking sense, but it didn't really feel like they did miss him that much. It felt like United kind of covered for his absence pretty well.
That's because of Luke Shaw, though, isn't it, as well? I mean, Maguire is a competent passer. I've always thought he's actually really good on the ball. Yeah. Martinez is another level. He's just brilliant with the ball at his feet. But well, that's a nice little segue. We'll discuss Luke Shaw then. He came off with an injury at half-time. I think many people feared the worst. Ten Hag said in his post-match press conference it was just a precaution because of his injury history and record. Hopefully, he'll be available for Luton at the weekend. But losing Martinez and then potentially Shaw picking up a little niggle, those two players are so key to how the team wants to build up and pass the ball. And it would be a massive blow to lose him, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I thought it was noticeable second half how...
You could really see the difference.
Yeah, how the play suffered by having four right-footed defenders, that it really did restrict their options playing from the back. And, you know, I think they looked okay without Martinez. I think the game probably suited them because there's less build-up play against Villa, because the way you get at Villa is by just going like that over the top and quick attacking
back
quickly.
To front, really,
yeah,
isn't
back
it?
To front quickly. You don't take 30 passes against Villa to get yourselves in the right position. You win the ball and you go, especially with the front three United have got. So I think I don't think that was necessarily a game where we were really going to notice it. It might be like against Luton or against Fulham coming up, where we really notice Martinez's absence and what he can do with those line breaking passes and the benefit of having that left foot right foot combo. The benefit of, you know, we talked about the Champions League at the start, the benefit of not being in it is they've got a full week to prepare for virtually every game now. They've only got two midweek fixtures left, which might change if they win another game in the FA Cup, but you know, at the moment it's virtually three midweeks constantly, so they've got a week to get Shaw right. But you know, they desperately need him to be right, because they've got no other left-footed option, and obviously they could play Dalot there if Wan-Bissaka's fit, but he missed training on Friday and obviously wasn't fit. So, you know, it restricts the options. And I mean, Malassi has been such a strange one. It feels like he's been close to a return a couple of times and then is still missing. They sent Reguil on back, which me and Rich again spoke about on Friday. I think that seems a bit of a strange move, that one. I don't know why they sent him back, really, why they went for that break clause. Unless they thought
they clearly thought Malassi was about to be back, didn't they? And he actually had returned to light training on grass. But since then, he's not actually been spotted, which is a concern. It's a red flag.
Yeah, and I mean, Ten Hag mentioned him on Friday, on his press conference on Thursday, just to say Tyre's still out. Which every time he says, I think he means me. I'm like, no, I'm fit. I'm raring to go. But, you know, they exercised that break clause in the first week of January with Reguil on. Whereas they maybe waited a few weeks, they might have thought,
You were a fan of Reguil, didn't you?
I always thought, considering how bad the first half of the season was, I thought he showed a lot of character and looked...
Yeah, I think in his first few appearances he did quite well, but I think there was a drop-off after that.
There's probably a drop-off.
He's at Brentford now.
He is. I think he's done okay at Brentford. I mean, he's only played a couple of times.
Watched him the other night, actually.
City?
Yeah, that was it.
Yeah, I just think, I mean, we don't know. If it's just a precaution, we're sure that hopefully he'll be fit. But having him now would also, as we mentioned on Friday, give Ten Hag the option of playing Shaw at centre-back and keeping that left-foot option in the build-up. But he is gone. It was 12 and out for Reguil. He's done and dusted. So hopefully Malassi will be back at some point this season.
Opposite side of full-back then, I think, I probably owe Dalot an apology. I sat on this podcast last week.
Down the camera.
I kind of said Diego Dalot was a Europa League standard full-back. But that cross was not Europa League. That was Champions League, that cross.
That was. It was Club World Cup.
In all seriousness, no. I mean, we've kind of discussed the battle with Wan-Bissaka at Lemps, haven't we? I'm cautious I've just done the Frank Lampard thing there when I went from laughing to serious in like a few seconds' time. But I think me, you and Rich, we've been edging into the Wan. Oh, no, we have been in the Wan-Bissaka camp. And Samuel, out of the four of us, has been in the Dalot camp. And to be fair to everyone, one second, is between the four of us, I don't think... It's not been a huge sway either side. We've recognised both players' limitations and we all agree, I think, that you need another right back. But Dalot has been really good since coming back into the team. And Wan-Bissaka's only had a one-year extension, so it feels now that Wan-Bissaka is going to move away and Dalot is going to cement his position.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm going to edge myself out of the Wan-Bissaka camp there. I'm not sure I was ever fully in it.
No, that's my point. I don't think any of us are fully... Do you know what I'm trying to say?
I think I always said that that Dalot had the higher ceiling as a right back. He just hadn't been hitting it since the World Cup. And Wan-Bissaka, you know, showed a fair bit of character to get back in the team last year and has done okay. But there's obvious differences between the two when it comes to Dalot going into midfield, which we've started to see a lot more since Casemiro and Martinez briefly was back. You know, it was obvious against West Ham that Dalot and Wolves that Dalot was moving in field and playing that midfield role again is, like you said, that's not a cross that Wan-Bissaka was ever going to deliver. So his limit attacking wise is a lot higher than Wan-Bissaka, and I think I always felt, maybe you can dig out an old podcast contradicting myself, but I'm pretty sure I always said that Dalot was the one I would keep and Wan-Bissaka the one I'd sell, and you sign another right back.
But they have had, I think you said, it's like a coin toss, hasn't it? And it has been. But I feel like now Dalot's come back into the team, I can't see Wan-Bissaka getting back in just because of the contract situation, the way Dalot's playing. I feel this is the last time now we're going to see a change at right back.
Yeah.
Because they've been flipping
so. The challenge for Dalot was to maintain this, because until the World Cup last year, he was probably United's best player or one of their best players.
Top three right backs in the Premier League, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, I think pre-World Cup. He'd certainly made that position his own. He'd been one of the big winners under Ten Hag. And then it went like that, you know, and it was gone for a while. This isn't like he's been this good all of this season. He's had struggles again this season, and he's hit a good patch of form now. He looks like the player everyone kind of knew he could be, but his challenge is to be producing this regularly, really. And if he is producing this, you know, if this is now his level, then yeah, I think he's made that position his own. And the only way Wan-Bissaka gets back in is an injury or Dalot moves to the left.
So discussed a lot of positives. I was going to give another shout out to Onana as well, because I thought he made a few important saves. But you kind of expressed a few concerns in the first part. They do need to control games better, don't they? Because Villa, as we said, goals decide games and narratives. But Villa could have easily scored themselves, and they were kind of on top for a large part of that match.
Yeah, they really were. And I just think they've got to... I mean, I think it's a bit simplistic, but one of the reasons they're winning games now when they weren't in the autumn is Onana's making saves and Højlund scoring goals. Like, I mean, it's a simplistic analysis, but
it's true.
Yeah. That is, you know, that is a big difference to what was happening in the autumn, and Onana was really good again. But they just, and I've said this all season, they give up way too many shots to long-term be a successful team. And I was, you know, I was looking through the earlier, 16 shots, Tottenham had 16 shots, Wolves had 16 shots, West Ham had 22, Villa had 23. You're living on the edge, really, winning those games. Obviously, the drew against Tottenham. West Ham was, we spoke about it last week, and that was a really clinical performance, but West Ham from their 22 shots, you shouldn't be giving West Ham 22 shots at Old Trafford. Like, you shouldn't have been giving Wolves 23 on the opening weekend. And it's just happening too often. I was flicking through it before, actually, and I know expected goals isn't for everyone's cup of tea, but
Samuel's not here,
so we can talk about it. Let's do the XG podcast. So only, I think it's the last 14 games. It's 12 or 14, can't exactly remember, but basically since the Everton game at Goodison, only one of those games, those 12 or 14 games, have United kept the opposition under an XG of one, which feels pretty damning, really. Like, if you look at all their top four rivals, I bet their record's a lot better than that. Like, they're giving up teams too many chances, and yet brilliant, and Arna's finding form now. But you can't rely on your keeper to bail you out every week. If you're going to finish in the top four, you've just got to be better.
Well, across the season, that's going to level out. You're going to perform how you allow and chance.
Yeah, exactly. You know, this is the thing. XG doesn't tell you. XG shouldn't be used to tell you this should have happened in this game. But over a season,
it's a long-term indicator.
It's a long-term indicator, yeah. It's not a 90-minute thing, really. It's a long-term indicator as to what's going to happen. And if you're regularly giving up more than one XG a game, it means you're pretty much going to concede a goal every week, which is, in a way, is what United do. And I just think they've got to tighten up there. And I was going to say it's an ongoing defensive issue, but I don't think it is defensive. I think a lot of it's to do with midfield. I mean, the space John McGinn got at times yesterday was staggering, really.
But they don't control games, that's my point. They don't have spells of where they really dominate matches and you can really see them playing the ball around. I mean, there's been glimmers of that in the last few weeks now. Players have come back to fitness. But, I mean, Pep Guardiola says that if you have possession, the opponent can't hurt you, can they? And that's the kind of, I guess, the approach you've got to have. And Villa had more of the ball. Yeah, I think you're right. It's not a defensive issue. It is a midfield issue. And you could extend that to the attack as well, because it all comes into one, doesn't it, really?
Yeah.
Pressing from the front.
Yeah, definitely. I just think too often players are out of position. And I don't think that's an individual thing. I think that's a tactical thing from Ten Hag. And
you know, I still don't think the pressing is what he wants it to be. And he's been here now for how long? Over 18 months.
Yeah.
And he's talked about how he wants them to press, but the press still isn't convincing. And that should be right by now.
Yeah, I think it probably should. And I always just feel like they're trying to set up like a City, in a way. You know, I was at City on Saturday, and you see, at one point, they had a corner, and I noticed what they did from a corner in terms of where they were stationing their deepest players is basically the same as what United do. But City get away with it because they do control games, they do dominate possession, and they've got this structure where, you know, Guardiola doesn't really like counter-attacks. He wants his players to make 20, 30 passes so that they're all in the right position. And if they ever do lose the ball, you know, City very rarely get counter-attacked on, because when they lose the ball, they've got the players in the right position to stop it. And the classic example for United is going back to last week when they conceded the third at Wolves. And as soon as that happened, I can't remember who it was, but as soon as the Wolves player got the ball in the centre circle, and it was basically a 2-on-2 or a 3-on-3, I just turned to Samuel and said, how are they getting counter-attacked on? Like, how is this happening at 3-2 up in the 95th minute?
It was unbelievable. It was really poor game management. But yeah. Andy lost the ball, didn't he? But even then, they could have still stopped it.
Yeah, and occasionally that's going to happen. It's a corner. There's a good chance.
3-2 up, you should not leave yourself exposed.
Yeah, you should have enough players back to deal with it. And I just feel like there's structural issues there that mean they're still too easy to play against at times. And
That's what I keep. It shouldn't be the case, should it? After this long, you can kind of. When I guess in a manager's first season in charge, you have the benefit of the doubt. You give them time; they're adapting, especially because it was his first job in the Premier League. But after a certain period of time, these doubts, structural doubts, should not exist.
No, they shouldn't. And I do think if they continue to be like this, then they won't get top four for me.
That was my last question for this part. Yeah. What can you foresee for the rest of the season? I mean, this month always felt like it was going to be a huge month. There's obviously some big games. Luton at the weekend, then Fulham. I was just checking who else they've got off the top of my head. Forest in the Cup. Then that's the Manchester Derby tie at the start of March. Everton at home. It's a big few weeks. It is a really big few weeks. But I think the encouraging thing is there is momentum now. And they are starting to peak, as I said, at the right time of the season.
Yeah, I mean, there's things working in their favour. That momentum, that character I talked about before, that I feel is a major change from earlier in the season. Anana making saves, Anana's form, Hoyland's form. There's obvious things you can look at and you think that's a big improvement.
Do you not think City's going to be the big indicator then? Because after weeks of progress and us praising positively, it could potentially be the real acid test. And it will show how much progress they've actually made because they are genuinely excellent opposition. They've not been at the best this season, but they're still top.
Yeah, but I don't think, as long as they don't lose 5 or 6-0, if they go to City and lose, you know, I don't think it should have that much bearing on the top four really, because no one's expecting them to win there. You know, that's not United's fight at the moment. That's the reality of it. I mean, the fixture list is interesting because they've played Villa twice now. They've played Tottenham twice now. That's realistically, I think, it's between those three for fourth, fifth and sixth. And United have still got the top three left to play. And then other than that, I think they've got, you know, Newcastle, Brighton and Chelsea to play. But they haven't got their direct rivals to take points off, which probably makes it a little bit trickier when you're doing the chasing, I think. So there's probably a likelihood that if they're going to get it, they will need to get a result against City, Liverpool or Arsenal.
And they'll need Tottenham Villa to
slip up in places. Maybe only one of them, because I think fifth would probably be enough. But if they continue to average the opposition, giving the opposition 17, 18 shots a game, I just think they're going to concede too many goals to get top four. So as positive as the last month, 6 weeks have been, as positive as all those improvements are that I've just mentioned, I still think there's more that needs to be done. They need to be harder to play against, I think, to get fourth.
I'm a glass half full kind of guy, but I'd have to agree. I think it's probably going to be one step too far because the first 6 months of the season were just so poor, weren't they? Yeah. And they've left themselves a big challenge. It's only 6 or 7 points, that's the thing, but it's the way, as you said, as they've been playing. Yeah. If you play like that and continue to play like that, although there has been encouraging signs, it probably doesn't bode well.
I mean, the one encouraging thing for them is that I'm not sure if they can catch Tottenham, but Villa, it feels like the momentum, we've talked about United momentum, it's working in the opposite way for Villa. They've started losing home games.
I think United will finish fifth and I think Tottenham will finish fourth.
I think fifth will probably be enough.
Yeah, well, is that how it works with the...
Yeah, as long as there's Premier League's in the top two.
Well, as we're going to say,
I think they're top at the moment, but a lot can change. I mean, if United finish fifth, they might need City to win the Champions League and Liverpool to win the Europa League or something like that. But
I think United would rather be United fans rather be in the Europa League.
Yeah, probably come like April and semi-finals, we'll have a better understanding of like how that's working out. But you'd think, City would go pretty close again, and you'd think Liverpool, Brighton, Villa, West Ham, all still in Europe. That
you'd fancy Liverpool to win the Europa League this
season. Yeah, you think enough teams would go far enough to make fifth enough for United.
That's it for part two then. We'll be back in a moment for part three. Welcome back to part three of the Manchester Is Red podcast. Ty, we'll get into some transfer bits here. Samuel wrote a line today about Bayer Leverkusen defenders Jeremy Frimpong and Edmund Tapsoba. Some interest from United. There has been some long-standing interest in Frimpong. A very exciting right-back. Obviously, Tapsoba is a centre-half. We were just discussing earlier on, down in the office, Frimpong's goal and assist contribution this season, which you look at it on paper, it's fantastic. I mean, 8 goals, 10 assists. Leverkusen are flying at the top of the league. They beat Bayern Munich at the weekend. He scored in that as well, didn't he?
He's got a really good goal, yeah. Neuer was up for a corner at the end.
I mean, we've just discussed Dalot and Wan-Bissaka there, but Frimpong would definitely be an upgrade, wouldn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know enough about him to know his defensive...
Definitely is a big statement.
...qualities.
Would you say he definitely is an upgrade then?
Yeah, I think he's got to be, hasn't he?
Yeah. I mean, I can't. If you put either of those players in the Bundesliga, I couldn't see them performing like that. So
no.
On that, but
his attacking output is, you know, even you put Wan-Bissaka in that Leverkusen team, he ain't doing that. But they do play, you know, Leverkusen do play wing backs, and they play very advanced wing backs. If you look at, I think Grimaldo's their left wing back. I think he's got a similar number of goals and assists, and their wing backs are basically wingers slash attackers.
He's actually been put down as right midfield on Transfer Market. If I looked at how often he's played on that side, but yeah, right wing back. He is a very attacking fullback.
Yeah, yeah. And the way they've played under Alonso this year, like I say, I think those two wing backs are in, maybe their second and third top scorers or something like this. They are really, really attacking. So I guess the challenge would be coming into a back four and doing it in a back four. Don't know, you know, I don't know enough about Frimpong to know how often he's played in a back four or whatnot. I think he has done it, but like I say, Alonso's Leverkusen this year, the wing backs are almost like wingers. They're that advanced. But his numbers speak for themselves. The quality of his play has been fantastic. His goal at the weekend was fantastic, really. I think he picked the ball up in his own half when Neuer was up for a corner, but he beat a couple of men, but it took him right to the touchline. But his finish from a tight angle was absolutely amazing. So, you know, he does look a serious talent. And again, I don't know a lot about the centre-back other than that he's been pretty highly rated in the Bundesliga for 2 or 3 years now. So two players who are clearly, you know, we've talked about that momentum before, they're clearly benefiting from what Alonso's done at Leverkusen over the last year or 18 months or so. He's brought players on an awful lot there. He's clearly a very good coach because some of those players have improved beyond recognition, and those two are probably two examples of them.
In terms of the priorities then, I mean, obviously that's a right-back and a centre-half. Could be some departures. Johnny Evans is out of contract. I'd actually give him a cheeky 1 year extension. I know his injury, there was concerns about his injury record, but he has had a few problems, but he's been available for a large amount of fixtures and he's actually had a really good season. Yeah. I'd give him an extension for the sole reason that I think Varane's going to leave, and is two departures advisable? If you give Evans another year, bring in another centre-half. So if we're seeing they're going to sign a centre-half tie and a right-back, which other areas? We talked about a striker. Ironically, you could kind of go through four or five positions and say that they need them.
You could, yeah.
Which we usually do.
I mean, a striker, with Martial going, a striker is clearly an absolute must. I think if Wan-Bissaka goes, I mean, I think, you know, we've said right-back is due an upgrade for a while now.
And then, but that's my point. So then if Martial's going, Wan-Bissaka's going, a centre-half, Varane, potentially, even Maguire could go, potentially.
The centre-back issue is an interesting one because it depends on how many go. Because you look at that and Martinez is probably the only one guaranteed to stay. Maybe Maguire now. But you know, there's always the possibility that if Maguire is told his third or fourth choice, the calibre of clubs interested in him this year might be better. So maybe it seems an opportune moment for both parties. But Lindelof's been really reliable for United. But at some point, will they want an upgrade or will he want to go and play elsewhere? Varane, he's out of contract this summer. He's clearly not going to get a deal at United on the same money he's on. So it feels like there's a lot of road to run on that in terms of whether they can come to an agreement. But you'd expect at least one centre-back to go. So I guess it depends at centre-back how many leave. But
it's almost like the hands are tied already, even months ahead of the summer transfer window. When we're discussing these departures from the squad, you're going to have to fill them.
Yeah, you are. And the you know, we're talking about the Champions League. I asked Ten Hag in the Sunday section of his press conference on Thursday about this. You know, we know how tight United are with the Premier League's financial rules, and earlier in January Ten Hag made a pretty telling point when asked about signing a striker, and he was like, I looked and there is no money. Like that felt like him making the point that, like,
I'm not surprised there's no money. He spent 400 million in two summer transfer windows. I mean, I've got the fees up here. I mean, 81.9, this is without add-ons, 81.9 on Antony, 64 on Højlund, 60 on Casemiro, 55 on Mount, 46.8 on Martinez, 43.8 on Onana, and 12.9 on Malacia. Eriksen was a free transfer. I'll again stress those transfer fees are without the add-ons. I wasn't going to rattle them on as well. Yeah. But with the add-ons as well, that's over in excess of 400 million. Yeah. And that's spent over two windows. That's not sustainable, because that is a lot of money.
That is a lot of money. But if they don't get in the Champions League, it is going to have a major, major effect on their budget this summer. And I asked Ten Hag about that, and he said, you know, he kind of admitted the budget would be affected and said we'll have more financial power if we're in the Champions League. So if they only finish sixth, you know, and the players they're losing, Martial is on a free, Varane would be on a free, Wan-Bissaka gets some money for, probably not loads. So I would worry for them and what they can actually do in the transfer window this summer. If I think that
they're really hoping Sevilla trigger Hannibal's 70 million permanent.
I think they'd consider selling a McTominay or a Maguire just because... Yeah. Though, especially McTominay, who's an academy graduate, or a Lindelof, whose fee is all paid off now, you know, players who would be pure profit because they would just have to. And we're talking about a right back, a centre back, a striker. You're probably looking over 100 million just for those three, really. You know, I don't think anywhere else really needs an upgrade. I don't think, you know, with Mainoo's emergence, I don't think you're crying out for a midfielder.
Well, it begs the question why Mason Mount was signed, wasn't it, last, and in hindsight in the summer.
Yeah. Kind of and I mean, Geong might be on the market now in the summer. I'm sure
he'd want to hear his name again.
Not spent on Mount and gone for Geong.
We're not doing that again this summer, Frankie De Jong.
Yeah, let's hope not. But I think, you know, the difference between Champions League and non-Champions League in terms of what United can do transfer-wise this summer, I think is going to be, it's going to be really, really substantial, because we know how much extra revenue comes with the Champions League compared to even the Europa League.
But I mean, in all likelihood, as we just discussed before, chances are they might be playing Europa League football next season, which will have ramifications. Yeah. I mean, we're doing this podcast on the 12th of February. We are.
There's lots of ifs and buts and maybes in our answers here.
Not a lot of absolutes, is there?
Very few absolutes.
Just to finish up then, loan watch, Facundo Pellistri scored against Barcelona, tie. 3-3 in the end, a draw in the Liga. We've kind of talked about his limitations at the club. He was kind of given a few chances this season. I think back to the game against Bayern Munich away from home. I think that was his big moment, but he didn't really take it. He started away against Bayern. But look, a decent start for and it's Granada, isn't it? Granada, I was going to say Gaddafi, that's missing Greenwood. But what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it was a tap-in, really, wasn't it, that he kind of...
He missed one before that. The ball actually got played over the top, and it was a very decent chance, but he fired one wide. Yeah, you're right, it was a tap-in.
It was a tap-in, but still, scoring against Barcelona is a you know, ticking the right box for sure. And just he just needs to go and play games, doesn't he? I think, you know, I'd be surprised if he made it United now at 22, really. And, you know, Ten Hag has barely ever started him, that Bayern game aside, really. So I think for someone like Pellistri, I think it's just a case of if he can get games between now and the end of the season and get 5 goals, few assists, something like that, then he puts himself in the shop window, which is good for him and good for United, really.
Well, we talked about his transfer fee, I think, 2 weeks ago when Arteta was leaving. We had a brief, $10 million. The thing is, I mean, he is a Uruguay international, and he does start for Uruguay as well.
He does.
Under Bielsa.
Yeah. I mean, there's clearly a player there. Like I said, I've never watched him really for United and thought he's going to definitely make it. I think he's had his moment as an impact sub. And as a sub, there's a lot of games when he's come on as a sub, he has made a difference. But long term, I don't think he's ever looked a United player. But, you know, his stature and his skill set might be better suited to La Liga. The problem with selling to La Liga is that none of those clubs have got any money whatsoever.
There's not much money around Europe at all, that's the thing.
No, well, this is the challenge,
Liga,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Selling players abroad is really problematic at the moment. Like Van der Beek, I mean, Eintracht Frankfurt have got that option on Van der Beek. I can tell you now they ain't going to be taking it.
I actually feel sorry for him.
I mean,
got into it a bit and discussed his poor start, but just, I think, 2 hours after that podcast finished, it emerged that he'd been omitted from their Conference League squad. Mm. And to be omitted from the Conference League squad after being there for a few weeks is so damning. It's a massive blow. I'm actually writing something on him for the weekend. Not that it's not been done. Book and verse. There's no new angle there, is there? We might as well talk about Ahmad quickly then before finishing the podcast, Ty. Now we've gotten to Pellistri, because Pellistri has, this is now his third loan, and if you go on 3 loans away from a club, you're likely not to succeed, are you there? I think it's fair to say. Ahmad had one, it was very successful. 2, sorry, as well. Rangers, but that was a failed stint. But his Sunderland spell was excellent. Ten Hag's made the decision to keep him for the rest of the season. But he's not getting a game. I think a few people would have expected to see him a bit more of him in the last few weeks, and it's just not happened.
No, it's not. It's not. And I still, you know, if Ten Hag is going to make a change down the right, either before game or in game, it's going to be Antony, isn't it, coming on for Garnacho at the moment. It's difficult to see where Ahmad's games come, because United have got 14 league games left, of which everyone is a cup final, as Ten Hag described them last week.
And I'm already sick of that, by the way.
Oh yeah, I know.
Every answer, isn't it?
I mean, every manager seems to be talking about how games are cup finals now. It's a little bit boring.
So the Twitter account, it's Brian's Gun, and they do the that'll be in that soon. That's probably already been done, to be fair.
It's difficult to see where his games come from. Maybe a couple of sub appearances, but beyond that, you know, I can't see him starting the game. You start to think it's maybe heading towards a point where he's sold in the summer, because he's not really had the chance at United. And that, you know, that injury he had at the start of the season has really damaged him at a time when he was, not damaged him, but damaged his prospects at United.
Because there was a lot of cup games and it was the start of the season, and that was the opportunity to give him a chance.
Yeah, League Cup games, you know, I was going to say Champions League games, 5th and 6th Champions League games, but they actually
were quite crucial in the end.
They were quite crucial,
But they would have expected to see, well, in an ideal world, that group would have been done and dusted with a few 2 games to go.
Yeah, and it's the, you know, that stage of the season is the opportunity for players like that to get games, but that injury took away a lot of his momentum, and I think has harmed his prospects. And if we get to the summer and he's made, you know, he's played like 100 minutes, probably less than that for United this season, it's hard to see where he goes from there beyond a sale, especially when we've seen how ruthless Ten Hag has been with those kind of 20-year-old academy products who should be in the team or not.
I think he's a better prospect than Pelescu, purely because I couldn't imagine Pelescu having the same impact in the Championship. Yeah. It's a different division, isn't it, and different skill sets, but Pelescu, like you say, better probably in the Liga, but Ahmed was fantastic in the Championship. And we've seen over the years the type of players to make the step up from the Championship, Jude Bellingham, Jarrod Bowen. It is actually a really good kind of education for these players. Yeah, so it'll be a shame, I guess, but you're right, it's circumstances, and when's he going to get a game? He just probably isn't, is he?
No, I don't know. I can't see a scenario, unless there's loads more injuries, I can't see a scenario where he plays much at all between now and the end of the season.
Anything else to add, Ty, on our little transfer segment? Transfer mix segment, wasn't it? I think it's fair to say. Is that all wrapped up?
I don't think of anything else. We are months away from the next transfer window, so I think we've done well to speak about it for that long, to be honest.
Thank you very much for your time, Tyrone.
Thank you, Stephen.
And thanks to listeners, as usual. Check out the Manchester It's Red podcast on YouTube and across our social channels. We'll be back on Friday as we look ahead to the Luton game. Have a great week and take care.